For the follower of Jesus, there's no holiday any grander than Easter. It represents the culmination of biblical prophecy and the very foundation of our Christian faith. Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection ignited a spiritual revolution that altered the course of history forever. Today on Insight for Living, we'll place our current series on hold in order to focus entirely on the biblical record in Matthew chapter 28. For the next 3 days, we'll trace the footsteps of the disciples who were eyewitnesses to the miraculous Easter weekend. Chuck Swindoll titled today's message, "As Dawn Arrived, He Arose."
There's a great tradition down through the ages where the churches around the world have responded to the message of the resurrected Christ. He is risen.
He is risen indeed.
He is risen.
He is risen.
He is risen.
He is risen.
Please be seated. If you have brought a Bible with you today, please turn to the last chapter of the first book of the New Testament, Matthew, chapter 28, which is one of the four stories in the Gospels of the morning of our Lord's resurrection. Matthew did not write first among the Gospel writers. Most likely Mark did, followed quite likely by either Luke or Matthew, and last was John, who wrote some 60 years later. But we read from Matthew's account in chapter 28, verses 1 through 8. I'll be reading from the New Living Translation. Early on Sunday morning, as the new day was dawning, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went out to visit the tomb. Suddenly, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven, rolled aside the stone, and sat on it. His face shone like lightning. His clothing was as white as snow. The guards shook with fear when they saw him, and they fell into a dead faint. Then the angel spoke to the women. "Don't be afraid," he said. "I know you are looking for Jesus, who was crucified. He isn't here. He is risen from the dead, just as he said would happen. Come, see where his body was lying. And now go quickly and tell the disciples that he has risen from the dead, and he is going ahead of you to Galilee. You will see him there. Remember what I've told you."
You're listening to Insight for Living. To search the Scriptures with Chuck Swindoll, be sure to download his Searching the Scriptures studies by going to insightworld.org/studies. And now the message called, "As Dawn Arrived, He Arose."
Have you ever been lost? I mean really lost. Like in a dense forest, or maybe at sea. Not in a mall. Not that. I remember a number of years ago, I parked and went into an entrance at a large mall, huge mall, big parking lot, big, numerous stores in the mall. I went through there and found my place and got what I wanted and shopped a couple of other spots and then walked out and someone had stolen my car. And I walked all over the lot. I mean, it was a big old parking lot as Prestonwood. I mean, a huge lot. And I couldn't find my car. And I finally called Cynthia and I said, "Well, the car's been stolen." "She's stolen?" I said, "Yeah, you probably ought to call the police, okay?" So I walked back inside and realized I'd gone out the wrong exit. So I walked down about 3 miles and walked out, and somebody parked my car right there just waiting for me. It's amazing. Not that kind of lost. The kind of lost Lewis Jordan experienced, age 37. Not that great a sailor, but he loved to fish. And strangely, he liked to fish off his sailboat, 35-foot boat. So he put out from the South Carolina shore and made his way out a couple of miles, 3 miles, and thought, this is a good spot to pick up some big ones. And while he was all involved in fishing, as you may recall from the report, a storm blew in. And of all things, it snapped the mast off his boat, and his boat capsized not once but 3 different times. Broke his shoulder the first time, and he is at sea. And the currents and the winds and the waves are washing him farther and farther out into the middle Atlantic until he winds up 200 miles and 66 days at sea. That's lost. His father was convinced he had lost him, his family beginning to grieve, confused, worried, sick about him. Along came a big German container ship named Houston Express, spotted him, reported it, and then the chopper came over, dropped the basket and rescued him. You imagine how that must have felt after eating jellyfish? I've been to China. I've eaten jellyfish. You don't want to try it. But if you're starving, you'll try anything. The only water he had was rainwater. GPS was ruined. All of his electronics were gone. He was at the mercy of the sea. Lost. I thought of him when I read what one of my friends has written. He said, "A friend of mine went swimming in a large lake at dusk. He was paddling a leisurely pace about 100 yards offshore, and a freak fog rolled in across the water. Suddenly, he could see nothing. No horizon, no landmarks, no objects or light on the shore. Because the fog diffused all light, he could not even make out the direction of the setting sun. For 30 minutes, he splashed around in panic. He would start off in one direction and lose confidence and then turn 90 degrees and swim in that direction. Made no difference. He could feel his heart racing uncontrollably. He would stop on occasion and float to preserve his strength, but he would blindly then strike out again. At last, he heard a faint voice calling from shore. He pointed his body toward the sound and followed that to safety. You have probably never been there or capsized at sea, maybe on a hike and lost for a little bit of time in a forest, but not really lost. Imagine being there on that lake and that thick fog surrounds you. You don't know east from west. You don't know sun up from sundown. You couldn't find the shore if you tried. You're lost. I believe that David might have had an experience like that when he talked about weeping may last for the night, but a shout of joy comes in the morning. When you're in the middle of a fog, everything seems gone, especially if the fog is a fog of disillusionment and disappointment and discouragement and even despair. That's exactly where the disciples were when Jesus died. A lot of us are so familiar with the story, we forget that. I mean, think of what they've given up. Their occupation. For 3 years now, they've placed all of their hope in this leader who was talking about a kingdom, and they were hoping they would reign with him. They saw him as he stood against those who were filled with legalism and others' brutality. They watched him as he healed the sick and calmed the sea and took care of the immediate needs around them, and they put all of their hopes on him until that last week where everything turned. And there's a mixture of confusion and disappointment and discouragement. No longer talk of a kingdom, no longer words of reigning with him and overthrowing the government and all the things they had hoped for. And when panic sets in, your memory fades. Have you noticed that? You can't recall what was said at crucial times. They have their last meal, and of all things, one of their own walks out to betray him. He's taken under arrest in a garden where you normally gather with him to pray. Mobs come with torches and swords and clubs, and they arrest him and take him away, and every one of the disciples that remained fled like rats on a sinking ship. Everyone. And you would have too. And so would I. It's all gone up in smoke, or maybe fog. Nothing makes sense. The next thing you know, word reaches you that he's been scourged. And you know what follows that. You live in that time when this sort of death happens. You can almost in the back of your mind hear the mallet as it drives those spikes into his hands and feet, where he dies in the darkness of noonday. And now your disappointment has turned to despair. It's over. How can you go back home without being humiliated and mocked by those who said you were stupid to follow this itinerant evangelist as he made his way into Galilee and then down into Judea? We told you so. You feel foolish. Worse than that, you feel afraid because as a follower of Jesus, they'll come after you next. Because the fog is all around you, You don't remember what he promised. Let me show you what he promised. Matthew 16. Just before that last week, when things turned south, Matthew 16, verse 21. Look closely. The ones I've been talking about were here to listen to these words. From then on, Jesus began to tell his disciples plainly, no theological gobbledygook, no prophetic unctions, no code talk. He spoke plainly in the vernacular of their day. Everyone there could understand that it was necessary for him to go to Jerusalem, that he would suffer many things, terrible things, at the hands of the elders, leading priests, teachers of religious law, look closely, he would be killed, he told them. On the third day, he would be raised from the dead, he told them. He's never lied to them before. He doesn't begin to lie now. That's a promise. I'm going to die. I'm going to be raised. Look at Peter's response. He pulled him aside, verse 22 tells us. He began to reprimand him for saying that. Heaven forbid, Lord. Don't talk like that. This will never happen to you. Jesus' response, if you wonder how serious he was, get behind me, Satan. You speak like the enemy. It's all part of the plan, Peter. The kingdom will come, but it'll be delayed. I must lay down my life for the souls of men and women. I must die. I will be raised. Don't silence the message. Spread the message. But the fog is too thick. Peter, within minutes, didn't even remember what Jesus had promised. Chapter 17, as if that prediction wasn't enough, look at verse 22, verse 23. After they had gathered again in Galilee, this is the same group who had heard it the first time, he told them the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of his enemies. He will be killed. On the third day, he will be raised from the dead. The disciples are filled with hope? No, they're filled with grief. Ever grieved? Remember how your mind went blank? All you could think of was the loss. It's part of the fog. Psychologically, you drift into a sense of deafness, blindness. I doubt they remembered he had told them that before, not that long ago. You would think one of them would have said, you've already told us. They don't say that. And if the two were not enough, go to chapter 20. Again, the last week before all of this happens. Verse 17, as Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples aside privately and told him what was going to happen to him. It's deja vu all over again. It's the same message. He knows they haven't taken it in. Maybe now they will. Listen, he said, we're going up to Jerusalem where the Son of Man will be betrayed. He'll be betrayed to the leading priests and the teachers of religious law. They will sentence him to die. Listen to me, men. I'm going to die. Then, he says, they will hand him over to the Romans to be mocked, flogged with a whip, crucified. But on the third day, he will be raised from the dead. Three separate times, very simply and plainly, he told them what would happen. Three separate times, they turned a deaf ear. You know what follows this? The mother of James and John comes to Jesus rather soon after he says this, as if he never said anything, and says, Lord, would it be possible for my sons to sit on your right hand and on your left in the kingdom? Now, they're not going to be in the middle. That's your place. But could you put one, James here and John there? Or maybe James here, John there. That'd be so good, just for this Jewish mother. Please, please. She didn't get it. They didn't get it. They're all concerned about who's going to sit where so they'll be seen and known. There's an argument in the Last Supper together over who will be the greatest in the kingdom. Now, we sit in this place rather comfortable, and we can't imagine people being that dense because you forgot about the time you were lost. You didn't know east from west. You couldn't remember the way you got in the forest or the direction you sailed when you were at sea. Or where the shoreline is. And the longer you're there, the greater the panic. And your mind is a blank. Panic fills you with fear. You know what's interesting in the whole story? The enemies remembered what he said. Look at chapter 27, Matthew again, 27. We're moving ahead. We've come now beyond the crucifixion to the day after, Saturday. We've arrived at a Saturday when the leading priests and the Pharisees, those who had had such an important hand in his being arrested and put to death, they're now troubled. So who do they visit? They visit someone in authority whose name is Pilate. Remember him? He's the one who was never convinced of the guilt of Jesus. He's the one who declared him guilty but never found him guilty. He's the one who said, What wrong has he done? I think Pilate, from that moment on, had tongue in cheek regarding the whole thing. He saw who the guilty ones were, anti-Semitic that he was. So they went to see Pilate, nevertheless. So look at the next verse, 63. They told him, "Sir, we remember what the deceiver once said when he was still alive. After 3 days, I will rise from the dead." Would you look at that? We remember. He said he was going to come back from beyond. We got to keep that from happening. Why, things would be worse now than they've ever been if that were to happen. The last thing we need is an empty tomb. So help us out, Pilate. Look at his response. They say, "We request that you seal the tomb until the third day. This will prevent his disciples from coming and stealing his body, then telling everyone he was raised from the dead." See, they didn't believe in a resurrection. They believed that the disciples would work out a plan to get the stone moved aside. They could go in, grab the body, run with it, hide it, and then they could announce he's been raised from the dead, just like he said. So let's keep that from happening. We don't need any of that grave robbery stuff. Look at Pilate's response. Again, tongue in cheek. "Well, you take guards and secure it as best you can." See, I don't think he believed they could secure it enough. Somehow, I believe in the heart of hearts of this man Pilate, he hasn't seen something more than the others around him. "You do the best you can." So they sealed the tomb, posted guards to protect it. So what do we have? A sealed tomb, frightened disciples in hiding, opponents of the whole story making sure that body wasn't going to be taken. But I've left out the body. What's going on in the tomb? Isn't it interesting? We're never told in the scriptures the details of what happened inside the tomb. I mean the intricate details. No hands unwrapped the cloths that had wound around him in mummy fashion. No human hands removed the bindings. No human hands enabled him to slip from that like out of a cocoon. No men and women's hands transformed him to a glorified state. As one writer puts it, he slipped from those wrappings like a large insect sheds its outer shell. It was as though the divine chrysalis had quietly emerged from the confines of its cocoon. Picture that. Wrapped like a mummy from feet to neck, a headpiece to tie the jaw up closed so that it doesn't open when the body decays in the grave, the cloth around the head and the wrappings were unchanged, except they just sort of sank and lay there on limestone inside the tomb. And before the stone is ever moved, he departs from it. You see, the whole molecular structure of the body changes when it's glorified. Not only is a glorified body able to move thousands of miles in an instant, you can move through objects that are solid, whether it's wood or stone, whether the door is locked or just closed. He's out. The stone is removed to let people in to see, not to let the supernatural out, to appear.
Most of us are quite familiar with the events that preceded the resurrection, but Chuck Swindoll brings a fresh perspective to this radical story of redemption. This is Insight for Living. To learn more about this ministry, visit us online at insightworld.org. The disciples were crushed by the tragic treatment of their beloved Jesus. They couldn't begin to imagine that a new dawn was coming. Well, we often hear from listeners who tell us their heart-wrenching stories that follow a similar path of hope and redemption. Recently, we heard from a mother in Tennessee who wrote us and said, "Chuck, as a happily married wife and mother of three, I felt like I was living the perfect life. One evening, our lives changed forever. During a season when my husband was preparing to become a pastor, our 13-year-old son died in an accident in our home. In the following months and years, I survived by hanging onto the hem of Jesus' robe, by the threads at times. In addition, I listened to Insight for Living every chance I got because reading the Bible was too difficult for me. As I worked through my grief, your sermons carried me to a safe harbor. I will always be thankful to Insight for Living." Well, if you're among those who financially support Insight for Living, we hope this comment serves to reinforce the importance of your generosity. Your contributions are the lifeline for someone who desperately needs a touch of God's grace. And if God's Spirit is nudging you to financially partner with us in this worthy cause, here's how to get in touch. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888. Our phone number once more, 1-800-772-8888. Or give online at insight.org. Thank you for your generous support of this nonprofit ministry. Chuck Swindoll continues our preparation for Easter, tomorrow on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, "As Dawn Arrived, He Arose," was copyrighted in 2015, 2016, and 2020. And the sound recording was copyrighted in 2020 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.